What do you call a writer who creates a series of stories based on outlandish supermarket tabloids? Or who writes a collection of stories called Severance, about the dying thoughts of people who've lost their heads, literally? Or one whose work titled Intercourse is the imagined monologues of 50 famous couples as they have sex? What do you call the creator of such imaginative stories? Well, usually we call him Robert Olin Butler. Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today I'm going between the lines with Pulitzer Prize winner Robert Olin Butler. For decades, Robert, or Bob as he's known, has entertained us with his exciting and poignant tales found in his award-winning novels and short stories. And now, in his latest novel, Hell, he gives us a harrowing and humorous satire of the afterlife and an underworld cast of characters wondering why they ended up in hell. Thanks, Robert. Welcome back, and I'm so glad that you're allowing us to go between the lines with you today.
I'm delighted to be here, Valerie.
Well, this is really a funny, yet compelling and fascinating book. Basically, Hell revolves around the afterlife of Hatcher McCord, the anchor of The Evening News from Hell. And in Hell, you even describe it in the book as a large, crowded metropolis with a vast tapestry of confusing Peachtree Streets. Does that mean that you've lived here in Atlanta?
I've spent enough time here. Yeah, almost all the streets in Atlanta are named Peachtree. It's true. My son and I live just 4.5 hours down the road, and this is our main squeeze of a big city.
Oh.
And my son used to rendezvous here and do the restaurants. This was in day of paper maps. And we stopped and counted one day. There are 62 streets in Atlanta that begin with the word Peachtree.
Tell us about physical description of your hell.
Well, it's a physical description, and it's an emotional, psychological sort of zeitgeist description too. I mean, it is intensely crowded. And you don't read this book for very long without getting the sense that everybody is here. It is very, very crowded.
Very inclusive.
Very inclusive indeed. And there's a kind of a feature of hell here that really terrible physical things happen to people. Like, for instance, there's frequently you get caught in the sulfur rain and your body dissolves. But you're immediately reconstituted back into your previous form to be tortured over and over again. And so it's fortunate that hell is this way because it allows me to mess around with my characters, and yet, you know, we can go on with the story, so it's okay.
There are supposed to be – was I correct in understanding that no unhuman living things, meaning no animals, no trees, am I
– That's correct. Right? No, that's correct.
Okay, so why did you have roaches in there? Does that mean that roaches are like humans?
I have known some roaches in my time, and I can tell you they're very like humans, yes. Yes, they are the one exception.
Yeah, but basically, though, there are no...
They're like the Greek chorus, though. I mean, they're always in great crowds in the corner, you know.
Dancing and singing.
Dancing and singing.
That's hilarious.
Cheering people on and boo-hooing. Yeah, they don't seem to mind it.
We talked about how just about, you know, everybody was in hell. Everybody from Mother Teresa to Dick Cheney. Do any of them really know why they are there?
No, and a lot of them don't. I mean, some probably can guess, the more obvious ones. Mm-hmm. But most of us, since we're all there, and even, by the way, I'm there too. There are a couple of places I am unnamed in the book, but I do appear. And the dust jacket photo actually is a little sort of postmodern comment on that. Anyway, there is a feature, indeed, that Hatcher McCord has devised on the Evening News. As he points out, Satan does seem to want the news to be the news at night. And Hatcher does a series of interviews in the book.
Why do you think you're here?
Exactly.
His main segment.
Everybody from Reverend Jerry Falwell to the guy who invented the electric hand dryer in public restrooms. You know, these are people that – those two probably should know why they're there. But this is a kind of a way in which we've introduce Hatcher's deep yearning in the book, which is indeed, if you find yourself in hell, and honestly we do even in life, this hell is very familiar in many ways. It is the fundamental question of why am I in hell, which is really a corollary of the question, who am I? Mm. And I find, you know, all literature is built around yearning. a character who yearns deeply for something and tries to get it. And if there's a unified field theory of yearning in literature, from where I stand on all this, it is I yearn for a self, for an identity, for a place in the universe. And that's, you know, at the heart, that's what this book is about. As we try to define ourselves in a circumstance in which things are very difficult. And, you know, that's not just life in the nether world. It's life in this world as well.
Well, you know, a lot of people think that this life that we're living is the hell.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. But you talk a lot, too, in the book about how hell really is the product of your own imagination and your mind.
Exactly. There are some things revealed in the book which suggest that hell is not as set in the way in its ways as everyone assumes. And we do create our own hell. That also is a feature in this world that I've created in the book, and I think reflects how we often live.
This hell reminded me in many ways of Dante's Inferno. He used historical characters also in his poem, and there seemed to be a Sisyphean type of torture going on in the book where people constantly are just doing the same thing over and over again.
Yes.
You know, so.
Which is indeed how we torture ourselves in this life. We make the same mistakes over and over and over again. And there's no reason for it to be any different in hell because we're very effective at that. And you're right. Dante, of course, anybody who writes a book entitled Hell has got that classic model preceding him. And Dante and indeed Beatrice.
Yes, his guy.
You know, Dante is referred to. Dante does not make a physical appearance.
Although no, he doesn't.
It's clear that he's somewhere out there.
Yeah.
But Beatrice does. And she plays an important sort of pivotal moment in the plot.
And for those
too.
Who may not be familiar, Beatrice was kind of like Dante's guide or cope. So his, what would you call her?
His obsession, the young woman that he
was,
loved.
Okay.
In a kind of platonic way, although mm-hmm. you know his intentions may be otherwise, but they had this extraordinary sort of love affair, unresolved apparently, and so yes, she's definitely here and anxious to get out because Dante went in and came out, and so her assumption is well, there's got to be a back door here somewhere, and that also provides a through line in the book where
Hatcher
tries to figure out, in fact, there may well be a way out of here, which would be quite a story for his evening news.
Well, Hatcher had an interview with Satan, as a matter of fact, and afterwards he received this powder blue tie. So what's the significance of the blue tie? Because he seemed to have been a little empowered by it.
He was, and this was the first interview that Satan has ever given. Hatcher had a scoop. And once he had the interview with him, he was given the blue tie. And this is the sign, the blue tie and a blue jumpsuit sometimes too, is the sign of being a minion. I mean, there are the denizens of hell, and then there are the minions, those who work for Satan. And so Hatcher was officially invested. He is the, you know, Satan's anchorman, of course. He was finally invested with official status in hell as being one of the minions. But in that very interview, Hatcher learned some things that may give him a chance to exercise some free will down here that he said, I did say down here, didn't I? And I am sitting in Atlanta, of course. So I just revealed another how deeply this notion runs, I think. But yes, he is given minionhood and is able to use that indeed to further his investigation into why he might be here and whether or not there is a way out.
And there's a theme there too about free thinking. You were about to, I think, touch on it just now.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of philosophical notions brought up here. I mean, if you do believe that there is a God listening to you at all times, how are you ever then able – I mean, in what sense are you, in fact, exercising a freedom of thought and even action? And once it's not giving too much away to say that. He feels he has some kind of independent mind separate from Satan. And so it raises some philosophical questions. It raises some possibilities for action, but it also raises issues of responsibility and what you can do with such freedom and how you dare to use it and how you share it. There's a whole range of implicit philosophical questions that the book addresses.
I had
but thoughts. Very funny in funny ways. I don't
right.
I don't want to give an impression. This is not a philosophical tome.
No.
But it, you know, the way I write. I mean, the serious and the hilarious get intimately entwined. And if you know, and in this life too, if we weren't able to maintain that sense of things,
right.
we would all be mad.
That's right. One of the privileges that blue tie seemed to accord Hatcher was access to J. Edgar Hoover. So why was
yes.
that important?
Well, Hoover is a top minion. And, of course, he comes in and snatches Hatcher to take him to the interview. But
with
once
Satan?
With Satan.
Uh-huh.
But once introduced to Hoover and then with the sense of his own power, he convinces Beelzebub, who is Satan's station manager, the number two guy, getting good advice from Dick Cheney, by the way. In the book, he convinces Beelzebub to let him do a "Why Do You Hear?" with Hoover. And one thing that Hatcher gets out of Hoover's office by courting the succubus, who is his secretary, are some addresses. There are some people he needs to see, even from his past, his three previous wives,
right.
for instance,
right.
who he assumes are in hell, and of course they are. He to try to figure out why he himself is here. I mean, it's all part of the way in which the book.
Right.
There's a lot of little side bits. It's like one of those big Mad Magazine
yes.
cartoons where
yes.
there's all things going on the margins, which are sort of relevant and sometimes really relevant and sometimes just wildly there to set the tone. And there's a lot of that in the book. But there is a strong plot line through, and Hoover plays a part as well.
Dick Nixon. Too.
Dick Nixon.
He
keeps popping up.
He does.
I if he had his head cut off, I would have put him in Severance. But he is in Intercourse. I do Dick Nixon and Pat Nixon in Intercourse. I do. Yes. It's a nonpartisan book. Bill and Hillary are in there too.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
you right. know. So and Abe Lincoln and George Bush. I mean, there's a lot of
everybody's in there.
Yeah.
I
wrote a short story recently about Dick Nixon called 18 and a half, where I personally recover the 18 and a half minute gap in the Nixon Watergate tape.
Oh.
And it's Nixon going on an 18 and a half minute rant about when he met Elvis in the White House. And then certain other people make an appearance too. So
many in hell were talking about what they thought might be a second or a new harrowing. Define that harrowing with respect to this story, and how does it compare to the old English term harrowing of hell, which refers to the descent of Christ into hell to bring salvation to the souls that were held captive there? Is this the same type of thing?
Well, it is the same thing. Yes,
okay.
It's the harrowing in the biblical sense that there is one of the rumors in hell, and being an enterprising journalist, Hatcher pursues it. Is that there is a new harrowing in the offing, that Christ is coming back to take some other people out. And it fits in with the backdoor notion. There may be a backdoor out of hell, and there may be a new harrowing coming, and how do you qualify?
For the harrowing.
For the harrowing. Mm-hmm. And so Hatcher goes down to the part of town, and now with his minionhood, he has more freedom to move around. He goes
down to
the part of town.
Peachtree and Lucky.
Peachtree and Lucky Street is where the old harrowing took place. So he goes to an automat there, and actually Judas Iscariot is a major character.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Hatcher goes in pursuit of this story. And there are some really interesting turns of event in response
right.
to
and
in respect
Judas,
to that.
It was interesting. Judas's character was, mm-hmm. was interesting in here, too. Well, if you've just joined us, I'm Valerie Jackson, and I'm going Between the Lines with Robert Olin Butler. He won the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction for his story collection, A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. And he's written screenplays for most of Hollywood's major studios. Currently, he teaches creative writing at Florida State University. We're talking about his latest book, Hell. So why do you think Hatcher believe Beatrice implication, or rather hint that there was a, another way to get out of hell?
Well, you know, the, he believes it or hopes to believe. I mean, you know, it's and that's another way that we operate in this life, too. The belief is rumor plus vested interest plus hopes that something might be true. The way in which belief systems come about, the way in which possibilities for one's own personal future arise, it's in this intense mix of factors, and it reproduces that in a right. sense. But of course, Dante, according to Dante's poem, which when Hatcher meets Beatrice, he realizes that, you know, he says, whoa, you know, this really, he really was here. And if, yes,
that Dante
yes, he was
here,
exactly.
Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so once that becomes true, then seemingly true, then it goes from there. He begins to think, well, maybe because he came and he went. And so there may be a way out.
Right. So if he did it, maybe others
maybe
can.
Maybe I can too, yeah.
Well, like in Dante's Inferno, where an individual's punishment was often the opposite act of their sins, like, for instance, the fortune teller had the head turned backwards so they could never see ahead or see in the future what's ahead of them. You had some very creative tortures in your book, Shakespeare. What was his?
Oh, Shakespeare. Yeah, everybody has to keep up with the technology in Hill. Somebody like William Shakespeare. Has to write on a computer, and his hard drive keeps crashing. But I guess one of my favorites is Herman Melville, who also has to work with computers, and he has got a writer's block. He's stuck on the first sentence of his new novel, with the sentence being, call me email.
That's not right.
Of course, you know, remember Moby Dick started with Call Me Ishmael.
Right.
He's that's also hell. A writer just forced to try to repeat himself. You know?
Well, William Randolph Hearst was another old-timer, you know, who was trying to blog.
He's turned into a blogger. I mean, he was a media mogul, and he's turned into a blogger. And, of course, he doesn't know how to undo the caps lock. So he's been ostracized by all the bloggers because he can't stop shouting.
Oh, because everything is in caps.
Everything's
he
in caps.
He doesn't know how to unlock the caps.
He doesn't know how to unlock.
He sounds like me.
This guy always shouts.
So what do you think your torture would be in hell?
Well, I am actually in hell there. There is a moment, in fact, right after running into Humphrey Bogart and Beatrice, that Hatcher opens a door in this sort of back alley tenement that he's in. And he opens the door because he hears a little chittering inside. And he sees a man who looks very much like me, sort of in the dark, in front of a computer screen, and typing furiously away. And you know, I have been on Twitter for couple of months now. I do these what I call tweets from hell, these little 140 character basically bonus tracks, because the stuff that I'm doing isn't in the book, although I did one just a couple of days ago which answers your question, and this is in 140 characters, because I'm not named in the book, but this does describe the situation. And this is my hell. Robert Olin Butler types away in a tiny, dark room alone with his unconscious and unable to avert his eyes. This is hell, but it is heaven too. Mm. So, you know, writing books from the unconscious, which is what literary artists do.
Right.
It is always hell because it's scary there. It is really terrifying, but it's the thing you do that fulfills you.
What when you were a little kid, what was your vision of hell as a child? What did you think hell was?
Oh, man. It was probably traditional because, you know.
Fire and brimstone.
Fire and brimstone, I guess. Although, you know, it's a good question, but I don't remember dwelling on hell much when I was a kid. It didn't scare me a lot. Not enough for me to remember now, at least.
That's good.
Life is a lot scarier than especially in the 21st century.
Well, I want to speak to one of your other books for just a moment, Severance. Mm-hmm. Theory has it that consciousness lasts for about a minute and a half after a head has been decapitated. And you created a series of stories in your book, Severance, of possible monologues of beheaded figures, historical and mythical. And you said that this was, well, you've said in the past anyway, that this is your best and most ambitious book. Does that still stand true?
Oh, no.
Today?
That,
why?
I've said that when that was my last book.
Oh,
no, Hell is my best and most ambitious book, Valerie.
Okay, okay. When did you start to focus more on fiction than screenwriting? Because that's what you really originally started out doing.
Actually, no,
playwriting.
I started writing
playwriting sorry,
and
playwriting.
I was a terrible, terrible playwright. And I should have known better because my most impassioned writing was going into the stage directions. Now, that's a very bad sign for a playwright. I was a closeted fiction writer. And so I got rid of that. I became the fiction writer. And then after I won that prize, Hollywood started noticing me to some extent. And then I started writing some really good screenplays for hire. And those sort of daisy chained into nine screenplays for seven different studios. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, the last one I did was significantly influenced. Provided me with a piece of the puzzle that led me to write Hell.
Oh?
I wrote a screenplay for Robert Redford. Redford came to me, or his production company came to me and said, Bob wants to play an aging TV anchorman. Can mm-hmm. you write a screenplay around such a character? And I did. And Bob and I went, had lovely meetings. He's a swell guy, and we worked through that, and you know, I gave them a screenplay they loved, but it's in development Hell, mm-hmm. and of course that certainly
right.
that certainly inspired me. But in pursuit of writing this screenplay about an anchorman, I had very privileged. I was able to spend a few days hanging around, just like a fly on the wall or at their elbow, the late Peter Jennings and Brian Williams.
Oh.
And so I really learned a lot about that world and these guys. And the character that I wrote, of course, is not Hatcher McCord. It's quite a different character in the screenplay. But the anchorman
right.
notion
yeah.
stuck. And whatever inklings I had about in this 21st century, because the zeitgeist of the 21st century seems to me very familiar in this book, that was the piece that was missing. I didn't know the way into a book set in Hell, though I had especially writing all these short shorts about historical people and wondering where they might be now, especially dead historical people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All of that sort of fit together, and the Anchorman character was the key piece. And once I had him at the center of the story, all these other things, you know, came together.
So why is everybody in Hell, or so it seems? Is that
It's the
Does
human
that imply
condition, Valerie. It's just the human condition that we are.
So it's not so much about them being in hell down there, but just being in hell in the present state of mind, maybe?
That's certainly part of it, yeah. Mm. I mean, I'd hate to simplify it into
but
you know, that's certainly a major element that's implied in this book, sure. We create our own hell. We do it in our minds. We do it in our actions. And we do it in the world around us. Mm. And that's something that the book, I think, touches on.
Now, you do what's called, or used to be called anyway, a boot camp, a creative writing class mm-hmm. that was supposed to be really tough, or is supposed to be. and to your students, you've said that the most important thing a writer must do is to find his voice.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that? I know what some other authors mean, but...
Well, that is a crucial thing. I have been teaching writing for 25 years, and I used to teach before I won the prize. I taught in Louisiana in a state school there, McNeese State University, and I taught a lot of freshman comp as well. And I have found this to be true of writing of any kind, that the problem with writers is, in the way they've learned to write, is they've been forced to write in the voices of people that they're not. Little miniature sociologists or anthropologists or philosophers or political scientists or whatever. You're forced to take on the words and the voice of people that are not necessarily coming from inside you. Mm-hmm. And I have found that and I had great success in my freshman composition classes even, in forcing them to go back to be – to just their own natural voice, to not forcing them, empowering them to do that. And when they wrote in their own natural voice, even if it's a street voice, even if it's an inner city voice, even if it's a Cajun pierogi crawfish farmer voice, when they're writing in their own natural voice, a lot of the technical problems, the grammar and so forth, much of it clears up on its own because they are following the natural rhythms of their own communicative selves. And then eventually you get deep enough into your unconscious that you break through to a place where Jung called the collective unconscious, where you are neither male nor female. You're not black, white, red, yellow, or brown. You're not Vietnamese, American, Serbian, or Albanian. You're not Christian, Muslim, Jew, Hindu, or Sikh. You are human. And that fundamental authenticity that you can then tap into, the human authenticity, at that point, later on in your writing, you can channel it through the vessels of characters who might on their surface be quite different from you.
Right.
Because it seems a paradox that I have written in so many different voices, and women say I write in women's voices well, and the Vietnamese tell me that I've caught their voices. But that didn't happen until I was the master of my own personal voice. And that's the crucial element in all good writing.
And you say that art comes from the place we dream.
The unconscious. The dream space, yeah, the unconscious. Art does. A lot of other writing comes reasonably and appropriately from the mind.
Well, you talk about the emotional approach, the sensual approach, which I understand might be very applicable to an average length story, but how does one sustain that kind of emotional approach for a 500 or 600 page novel?
At great cost. I mean, that's why it's tough, and that's why the great Japanese film director, Akira Kurosawa, said that to be an artist means never to avert your eyes, and that is the crucial thing, because the unconscious is a scary place. And to maintain that deep connection to the place where all of your worst fears and all of your tremblings and all of your frustrations, it's a beautiful place too, but those other bad things are there as well. To maintain your connection there and without averting your eyes, it is a very difficult thing.
It could be hell even.
Huh? It could be hell, but it's also heaven, as I said earlier.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Robert. This has been fun. I appreciate you coming back with us, and I want to thank you for allowing us to go between the lines.
You're always a wonderful interviewer, Valerie. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you so much. Well, that's it for today. That's Robert Olin Butler. His latest book is Hell. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, go to our website at wabe.org/BTL and listen to an archived program. Or check out our suggested reading list for both children and adults. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to our website and click on Podcast. Be sure to join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. The executive producer of this program is Louis Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor and technical producer, Mike Johns. Assistant producer, Colin Baylor. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.